Gentlemen, well, this is going to be our final installment.
Final installment, sir. My name is Chris Wayne. I'm with Major General A.J. Tedley, and the date today is 28 August 1979, and we're at General Tedley's home in Saanich. General Tedley, last day we got you as far as finishing up in Cyprus. And I believe you were getting your plum for your endeavors. If I'm not mistaken, you were to take NDC.
No, actually, when I left Cyprus, I went directly to Germany to command
the 4th Brigade. I'm sorry, excuse me, here we go. I get my little cheat sheet out here. You go to command the 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade in NATO, which is the plum job, and be promoted to brigadier as soon.
Well, I was a brigadier all the time I was in Cyprus, and of course prior to that, because I was commanding 2 Brigade in Petawawa, so there was no promotion involved, but it certainly was the plum job as you describe it. I remember a reporter asking me how I felt about going there, and I said I was as happy as a cat with a bowl full of cream. I couldn't have been happier than to get that appointment.
Now, the date on this appointment would be what, sir?
Well, I went there in Christmas of 1964. I think I took over in mid-December. I was there for Christmas 64. And I stayed there until the Christmas season of 1966 for a 2-year tour. Actually, it was an interesting time to have the brigade because it was at the time we were changing it from an infantry brigade to a mechanized brigade. We had bought 300 APCs, the M113. We had bought some new helicopters. We had upgunned, upfueled, and up-armored the Centurion tanks. We had introduced the SS-11 guided missile to our weapon displays. We had formed a special unit of the Van Dusiem, which looked after the guided missiles. And it was a chance to get all this modern equipment and also some of our old equipment improved to the point where it didn't look very bad on the battlefield anymore, and chance to practice some new tactics using the new equipment in extremely good training situations, which we had in Germany.
Well, the major expenditures in 64, well, from 64 to 67, were the re-equipment of the Army's mobile force.
Yes.
Which you described in 64. I'm just thinking, was your equipment that out of date before? I find it hard to believe the Canadian government was actually thinking ahead.
Oh, this was a result of work we had done years before. When I was Director of Armor and Director of Combat Development, we were looking forward to what weapon systems we required to modernize our brigade in Germany, and this was the fruits of that particular labor, not my labor, but the labor of an awful lot of people. And as I say, it was interesting because we were really a very well-equipped and extremely well-trained brigade. And we made quite an impact on the British forces, which we were part of, as you know, because 4 Brigade was part of 2 British Division. And not only did we have the opportunity of practicing with our new weapon systems, but we also had the practice of, or at least the chance, to demonstrate to our British seniors just what could be done with a mechanized brigade of this nature.
At this time, there's talk of the unification, is that correct?
Yes, definitely.
And you missed the onslaught by being in Germany, or would you have your ear to the ground?
Well, ear to the ground to a certain extent, but the major impact it had on my brigade was the fact that I invited all the senior airmen from the air division to come up and see what we were doing, realizing, of course, as you know, that they were still in, the headquarters were still in Marville in France at the time. But I had people from the air division and I had people from Ramstein, which was the headquarters of the ATAF that the Canadian Air Force belonged to, the RCAF, the division in Europe. And I had them up and briefed them about what our roles were. And also at this time, we had visitors from Ottawa, a good many of them, as one does when one commands the brigade in Europe, and they were not in khaki anymore. We had deep blue and light blue staff officers. The chief personnel was Navy at that time, and he came over to see us, and we were beginning to see what the integrative process was going to mean to us, but it meant absolutely nothing to our operational role. So when I say I was apart from the integration, what I'm talking about is operationally I was apart from the integration.
You weren't seeing green at that point.
No, but interesting enough, my senior medical officer that they sent me for the first time was an airman. My legal staff was a mélange of air, sea, and land lawyers. So in my hospitals, not the field hospital, but the base hospital, we had, once again, a mélange of doctors from the three services. And this was the first time this had happened.
Hmm. Any particular feeling about it first?
No, not at all. In fact, as I say, in the medical and the legal profession, the people I got were top-notch, and we were delighted to have them.
During the period 64 to 66, while you're in Germany, anything come to mind of being a really important, I'm thinking, I guess, of any action from the Russians or?
Not a great deal. There was no big problem. Strangely enough, the two things that stand out in my mind, other than getting this mechanized brigade together and exercising it in the field, was the fact that the Canadian flag came into being. I think the official date for the flag was the 15th of February in 65. Well, we always had the red ensign flying over our various forts in North Rhine-Westphalia, surrounded by British forces because we're part of a British formation. And I think that an awful lot of German civilians believed that we were part of the British Army and not the Canadian Army. And to my mind, it was a great thrill to take down the Red Ensign, although I loved it and had fought under it. That's not true. Nobody really fought under the Red Ensign, but people like to say so, especially the Canadian Legion. But to put up a distinctive Canadian flag, we made so much of it, and I must say I'm the one that did this, that I invited the COs of the various brigades, the German brigade in the area, the Belgian brigade in the area, all the British brigadiers, the British divisional commanders, and we had a ceremonial taking down of the flag and the hoisting of the new one, and we had a great grand party with all our bands that we could lay our hands on and things of that nature. We invited the Burgermeisters and the Oberkreisdirektor and the Kreisdirektor and the Landrat and the various people, and I think from that time on, there was a new feeling amongst the German civilians. Yes, we have Canadian troops per se in our area and not just another British brigade. That I found to be a very satisfying thing to me personally and very satisfying to my troops. The second...
Well, keeping on with that, yeah. Why the troops? They really got behind the flag?
Yes, they did. It gave them a sense of identity that they did not have theretofore. And you could feel it. I found an improvement in morale immediately. And there's something I must go on record as saying, because I'm not a liberal, as you know.
Well, this is the consequence
of it. Difficult. No, that's a joke. Actually, I found it was a good thing, per se, according to 1066. No, and I was going to go on, though, that the other thing was the Queen visited with us in May of 65. And that was without doubt, I guess if I look back on all my military career, the thing that stands out was the fact that I was able to put my brigade on parade in front of the monarch. She came for the first time as the Queen of Canada. We had the new Queen's colors with our various regiments and battalions. We had a mixed guard of honor with 50 airmen from the air division and 50 soldiers from my brigade. The Air Force sent up their fighter planes to fly over the parade as it was taking place. The thing was, I think, extremely well done. The Queen was charming, and we had a wonderful time with her. Here again, we were able to ask the Kreisdirectors and the Landrats and the Burgermeisters of the various towns that we were occupying. Our forts were spread all over North Rhine-Westphalia, or that part of it, and as a consequence, we were able to show them some hospitality. The Queen didn't stay for lunch with us that day, but I had all these German officials in for lunch at the Officers' Club, and of course they were in the stands for the big review, and I think this was extremely well done. And then Sir Mickey Stirling was the commander of British Army of the Rhine, and he invited me to dinner that particular night. I drove down to Senelager, where they had a formal state dinner for the Queen, which I was honored to be at, and in addition, Sir Mickey had arranged for each of the brigadiers in the British Army of the Rhine to have a 20-minute special talk with the Queen, just the brigadier and the Queen alone, which I found very, very interesting. Of course, I had been with her for 5 or 6 hours that day at her side, so we had a chance to chat informally, but that particular 20 minutes at night after dinner was very interesting.
What do you say to the monarch after dinner?
Well, first of all, I thanked her on behalf of my troops and their families for coming to see us, because she was just wonderful with the Cubs and the Brownies and the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides and various church groups and so forth. She was just perfect, you know, and it's great for morale. And I thanked her that way. And then we talked about family matters mostly. She asked me about various people that she knew in Canada and how they were getting along, particularly then Colonel, now General Roy Reed, who had always been one of her equerries when she came to visit Canada, asking me about various people she knew. When she found out I was from Montreal, asking me about some of the colorful characters around Montreal, I found it the most charming evening.
That was great. The brigade in NATO, as you say, your task, if you will, in 64 to 66 was to mechanize and to hone, I guess. Is that right?
We still had, while we were doing this, of course, we still had a very strong operational role, which I won't go into now, but the point is that we had to keep our operational standards up at the same time as we were changing equipment. So it came, it was very interesting, and a lot of hard work involved in doing it.
So it wasn't purely a social, but a laid-back plum in the sense of just that, like being a flag officer Pacific.
Oh, no, it was...
No, they worked too.
I don't know, I've never been flag officer Pacific, I don't know how much they laid back, that would be unfair. No, actually, it was a very, very interesting time with lots of hard work, and I
think
that...
I'm going to get in trouble here when I say
that. Yes, I was going to say, don't let me name it, I'll hear you say that.
No, that's unfair. Not flying officer Pacific, but you know what I'm getting at.
It wasn't a social. But strangely enough, you know, the social implications of the job have a great deal to do with it. The Crown supplies you with the most beautiful house, called Hilltop House, on the hill overlooking the Menace, which has the Mona Dam in it, you know, where Gibson and his Dam Busters did the big thing during the war when Gibson won his VC. You can look right from my living room window at the dam, and you could see the holes where they had been repaired in the dam, so it was a very historic place. In fact, the anti-aircraft guns protecting the dam were in the back garden of Hilltop House. They weren't there anymore, but of course you could see the marks where they had been. It was a very historic place to be, and as I say, the Crown supplied us with this beautiful house, adequate servants. We had a cook and a putzfrau, and we had a table maid.
What?
And sort of. A putzfrau is the person who cleans the house and this sort of thing.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we had two gardeners to look after the grounds, because they were beautiful grounds. And when the Crown gives you a house like that to live in, they expect you to use it to entertain, and as a consequence, we entertained an awful lot of the local people. A good many of the civic officials of the various towns. I made quite a thing of that. I thought that was terribly important. But also, great number of politicians from Canada and... Well, not so much in their junkets.
The
we didn't see very much of the Americans except the boys that had to do with the nuclear business that we were involved in. We had Americans with us for that, but that was all.
But nuclear business, what, the atomic anything?
Or yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I had a, you know, a Honest John battery, and I had also some other.
So you were a pretty effective little...
We were. I hate to say it, it sounds terribly considered, but we were good. We were good.
What about today?
Since they moved from North Rhine-Westphalia and moved down into Wittenberg and Bavaria and that area in the south, I really don't know. I haven't been in touch with... I go over there because I happen to have a son-in-law who's a fighter pilot, and they're always very courteous to me, and they show me what's going on, and I'm sure they're just as good as we were, but whether they're operating in the right area or not is another thing entirely. You see, up there we were big. Down there we're submerged with the Americans and we're small again.
During this time, you come out in 66, and I'm not trying to rush over this because I know it's important, but the major things in the, well, I guess the whole Canadian forces come to a, not a grinding halt, but are certainly shaken with integration, with to be later followed by a reduction in Europe. Any knowledge, foreknowledge at this time that there was going to be a reduction in Europe and things like that? That integration and a reduction in Europe were going to be a hand-in-hand type affair? Or maybe I shouldn't say hand-in-hand, but...
I did not know during the time I was there whether we were going to be cut back. And we certainly didn't act as though we were going to be cut back because actually we were building up.
No,
the introduction of the SS-10, the special Company B of the Van Duzen M. As I say, new helicopters, we built a new heliport to look after that. All that was indicative to me that we were going to have the strongest brigade, I think, in NATO. The strongest single brigade in NATO.
Just good times ahead, everyone.
I didn't think of it. When you've got a job like that, you think of the day-to-day problems and you think, how are we going to train this organization to make it even better than it is? That's really what your job is, with your eye on the operational role. Mm-hmm. And we used to spend an awful lot of times in the EDP area, the emergency defense position, making sure that we were integrating all these new weapon systems and the improved tanks and so forth into our EDP role to make sure they would be more effective should the balloon go up. Mm. So, as I say, that had very little effect on us. And I didn't know at that time there was going to be any reduction in the brigade at all. I didn't even know it was going to move to the south. Now, the planners might have known in Ottawa, but they certainly didn't tell me.
Okay. What about the... I don't know how to describe this, but the change in the German forces in the sense that in the 50s, early part of the 60s, they were glad to see you, and whatever you said was fine. And by today, it's you got to check with them first.
I had three roles, really. One in the EDP, one in the thing called a Burkhan contingency plan, which had to do if anything went wrong in Berlin, and one that had to do with the evacuation of people in the event of a war. And it was only in that latter role that I had any great intercourse with the Germans, because the area commander in the district we were working, General von Papa, was my boss in that particular role. And I found him to be a charming man. He was an old Panzer Grenadier, and he and I had a great deal in common. Smoked the most horrible, ill-smelling cigars, but a very fine gentleman with a charming wife, and Marg and myself became very, very friendly with them. His staff officers I found to be very, very efficient and very helpful. Locally, in the brigade area, we had a flak brigade of the 13th Brigade, equipped with Nikes. The commander of that formation and I were very good friends. The Panzer Brigade in the general area, the commander and I were good friends socially. We worked together frequently. We did exercises together. We did a demonstration for the Bundestag one day, where our ambassador, who at that time was John Starnes, who later became the director of security, brought down the members of the Bundestag. We put on a display for them of our new weapon systems, and we also integrated a German tank formation into the large-scale exercise that we presented, and it was very good. I enjoyed working with them, and they certainly didn't put the arm on me at all, and I didn't find that they felt that we were intruders at all. In fact, they seemed very happy to have us.
No, I guess what I'm not getting at is intruders, but the point is, I guess it's more noticeable after the reduction for Canada. But I'd be glad to believe prior to 65, whatever, 66, 67, 68, Canada had a lot to say. Like, Canada's word was taken as advice. Canadian Brigade was going to do this, and everyone thought, well, okay, that's fine. Whatever the Canadians want, or what do you as Canadians think? But after this reduction and all these other things that happened, there was a different attitude. Canada's opinion wasn't held in such great esteem as it once was.
I've heard that, but as I say, I wasn't part of it by that time. When we were there with our brigade, which was hot, and the air div, which was hot, and I knew the air div was hot long before I went there to work in Germany, because when I was a student at the National Defense College, I remember one of our visits was to the Baden-Solingen base where Bev Christmas was commanding, and everybody was impressed, not only the Canadian students on the course, but the British and the American students and the civilians from all three countries, at the efficiency of our air division. It was a top-notch air division, and I think we had a top-notch brigade to go with it, and therefore, even if Canada didn't have much clout, we certainly had a great deal to be proud about, because they were darn fine formations. And when we would go to, as I did, to SHAPE-X and the various exercises at NATO and SHAPE headquarters, they listened to us. They listened to us in our day. One of the interesting things, and maybe this should be put on tape, they were trying an exercise in cross-fertilization, and that means to take brigades of various nations and put them under a division of a single nation to see what would happen in the event of a nuclear war when communications were bad and people would be rambling all around the battlefields, try to group them together to make viable formations again. And I was given the job of working for a Belgian division in the spring of 1965 on Exercice Printemps, and I was put under General de Schmidt of the Belgian Army. And it taught me a great lesson. We went to his orders group the day before the exercise, or the night before the exercise started. And he, coming from a bilingual country, had to give his orders in, first of all, in French, which took about an hour and 20 minutes, and then in Flemings, which took another hour and 40 minutes. And then he said, parce que nous avons brigade canadienne ici aujourd'hui, maintenant les ordres en anglais. To which I jumped to my feet and said, sir, I understood everything you said when you gave your orders in French. Let's not give them again in English, or the war will be over before we get into it. And this taught me a lesson that a formation in the field must have a lingua franca of some sort or another. And I think I'd explained to you that when I was in Cyprus, I supplied rear links to all the formations so that the communications coming back to my headquarters were all in English, even though the Finns worked in their language and the Danes in theirs and the Van de Zien worked in French forward. Everything that came back at the controlling headquarters was in one language. And I found this to be true, and I brought this up at a SHAPE-X exercise a few months later. Whether it made any impact or not on them, I don't know, but it certainly made an impact on me, that there's got to be a lingua franca within a formation. Whether it be English or French couldn't matter less, but the point is it's got to be one or t'other. It can't be both. When the B&B Commission came over to see me, I went to the extent of getting my corps commander and my divisional commander, both were very dear friends of mine, to come and show B&B what happened in that formation in the event of a war. In other words, where you could start speaking the language of, in this case, the Bandus, in other words, French. Because you had attachments and detachments from various organizations in the British Army. You might have flails and flamethrowers and things of that nature detached from the Funny Brigade to us. And you could not speak to them in the French language. Therefore, the language of the brigade had to be English. Don't know whether it made a great impression on them or not either, but I, as I say, I went to that length, to have our very senior British formation commander show how an operation took place, how the corps commander gave his orders to the div commander, and the div commander to his brigade commander, and the brigade commander to the regimental commanders, and that they had to be in a common language, mm-hmm. not bilingual.
Can't be done, right? What about the French? What was your relationship? I'm talking about French Canadians.
Never saw them. Never saw them.
They talk about them.
No, really, once again, you know, when you had your own little job to do, you really didn't worry about what was going on in the other area.
I'm just thinking of the grander scheme, France.
Oh, one personal thing. I remember I had to go to a NATO or a SHAIC meeting in Paris. This is before they moved, of course. It was at a time when there were all sorts of assassination attempts mooted about on de Gaulle. And I arrived wearing my uniform and carrying my briefcase with some secret papers in it. And being lying at Orly Airport, being made to stand against the wall while they frisked me and went through my briefcase, which I objected to most strenuously, but I wasn't traveling on a diplomatic passport, of course. I was a soldier. I thought that was a bit much, but maybe. I know the security business pretty well, and maybe that's what they had to do. But I didn't
they
like
it. They don't play around when it comes to that type of thing, do they?
No.
You leave NATO, Germany, you leave the brigade in 1966, early 67, is that correct?
Yeah, late end of 66.
And come back to
Winnipeg, actually, to training command. A little anecdote, you know. We had a commander's conference, a worldwide Canadian commander's conference, and in Ottawa, just before I left the brigade, about 2 months before I left. And at the meeting that night, they had Dick Stovall, who was the SASO, or whatever they call him in the Air Force, of the Air Div. And I said, what the hell are you doing here? This is a commander's conference, and here you have staff officers. You're kidding him about this.
Mm-hmm.
And when the meeting was over, the chief personnel called me over and said, oh, Jim, I guess you'll be wondering what you're going to do when you leave the brigade. And I said, yes. He said, well, you're going to go to training command to be Dick Stovall's deputy. So then I found out then why Dick Stovall was at the commander's conference. Whoops! However, Dick and I have been friends for many years.
Got away with it that time.
I came to training command, and this is the first time I got myself involved in integration. Really involved.
Well, that was already online at this point.
Yes, indeed. They put the training command together under Freddie Sharp during the time I was out of the country. Dick Stovall took over from Freddie Sharp. Freddie wasn't there very long. By the time I got there, they had decided what schools and so forth were going to be run on a joint basis and a combined basis. I found it a fascinating job. I liked working for Dick Stovall. He was a good chap. I was chief staff training and deputy commander. I wore two hats in that particular job. I was Dick's alter ego, and also I was responsible for all the training in the Canadian forces. And it was
Canadian forces.
Yes, Canadian forces. No, I had been, as you know, DMT before in the Army side, but this was the first time that I got involved. I had an extremely good staff. My senior naval trainer was Andy Collier, who became became the big admiral on the East Coast. Just gave up that job, Maritime Command commander.
West Coast prior to that.
Yes. Oh, yes. Andy and I have remained great friends. He was a captain at that time. My senior airman, chap lives right here within five blocks of me, Bob Hunt, was extremely good air trainer, and I had once again, that famous infantry soldier, Bucko Watson, who I had out in Cyprus with me as my senior army trainer. So I was in very good shape across the board with the three services. And I found that integration, as opposed to unification, which we might wish to discuss later, I was very much in favor of it. Let me give you a case in point. The first year I was there, we saved literally millions of dollars in, instead of having four or five schools of cookery in the country and five or six schools teaching people shorthand and typing, we had one. It was just amazing, the savings in that sort of thing. And as a consequence, I became very, very interested in the integration of the training process, in the money it was saving the Crown in running schools. I ran into a tremendous amount of operational flack because they said, how can you, whose job throughout most of your life has been operational, allow some organization to train our recruits when we have been training our recruits? How can somebody other than tank gunners train tank gunners? And I said, it's still tank gunners training tank gunners, but now we have a central control over it, and we're saving pots of money, and we're turning out as good a product. Nobody ever proved that we were turning out a less efficient product.
Well, let me give you this. Famous Admiral in town's favorite joke is the only thing in common between a Navy cook, an Army cook, and an Air Force cook is that they all can't cook. And having one school didn't help it any.
He confused the question of operational on-job training with the basic ab initio cook's course. What we're talking about is you teach the people the basics in one place. I have the most tremendous admiration for the senior service, and I've spent a lot of time on our Canadian ships. My wife was a Wren during the war, so I've got to be nice to the Navy. But they're always overstressing the fact that sailors spend so much time at sea that when they come ashore, they have to have a school of cookery, and they have to have a typewriting school or whatever it is, right in the dockside so that they can be with their families. You look at it statistically, soldiers are away from their families one hell of a lot longer than any backlog. But we just didn't have the propensity to go with it. However, there we are.
What about the Green?
Only story about the Green is we were host to the Pan Am Games. I was one of the first six uniforms produced for training command.
1967.